before the U.S.-led invasion in 2003. Attacks by guerrillas have entirely shut down the country's northern oil fields, while political parties in Iraq's south fight over lucrative revenues from smuggling oil to Iran and elsewhere. Oday al-Basri is a resident of Basra.
It's an organized process. The Saada people take a share. The Fadila Party takes a share. The Supreme Islamic Council takes a share. And the other thieves take their share, too. Even al-Maliki gets his share. I mean, don't the British or the Americans steal it, too?
Basri says the average resident of the South has more urgent concerns than oil.
Last night, my four-year-old son jumped into my bed when we were sleeping on the roof. We heard sounds of bullets being fired at the British base that is close to our house.
Faisal al-Atrashi lives in Kirkuk, the site of the country's second-largest oil field, where production has been frozen. He says that in Kirkuk, the closure of these fields is seen as favorable to neighboring states.
Iraq is forced to buy oil from the other countries or buy electric generators. That is why they bomb the power plants. It is like every country has their agenda in Iraq.
The current security situation has left many wondering whether it's possible that the Iraqi government could enforce any law that is passed. But analyst Antonia Yuhas stresses the law looks beyond the short term.
If this law is passed in Iraq, yes, the Iraqi government is weak. Yes, there's a war going on, but it still gives the signees the opportunity to say, I have a right to this oil. And it, in the case of this law, I have a right to 30 years worth of oil. There's nothing new about a country being forced to pass a law with a weak government and people who resist those laws, and the laws serve as foreign corporations very much against the will of the people. That happens everywhere, unfortunately.
The strike ended with promises of higher wages for the workers. Iraq's union has a considerable amount of clout. Oil exports account for 93% of the country's current budget. I'm David Enders for FSRN.
Lawsuits filed by the federal government of Nigeria and the government of the northern state of Kano against pharmaceutical giant Pfizer allege the company carried out an illegal drug trial on Nigerian children in 1996, leading to at least 10 deaths. The suit claims damages totaling $10 billion. FSRN's Sama Lokoya reports from Lagos.
The U.S.-based pharmaceutical company Pfizer carried out a drug trial on 200 children at a hospital in Kano, northern Nigeria, during an outbreak of meningitis 11 years ago. Some of the children involved in the trial died, while many others suffered physical disabilities. The Nigerian government claims Pfizer is responsible for the deaths. Tunde Irukira, attorney for the Nigerian government, says it's been difficult for the government to take action against Pfizer because the company concealed vital documents relating to the drug trials.
It's become clear that Pfizer has never really admitted what its motivation in going to Kano in 1996 was. To date, Pfizer continues to misrepresent what its real motivation was. Secondly, there's a significant amount of documents that Pfizer has in its possession that the plaintiffs, in this case, the governments, have still not had the opportunity to look at, which Pfizer has not disclosed. So that material concealment has significantly impeded the government's ability to pursue its legal remedies.
The Nigerian government says the drug trial was illegal because Pfizer did not get consent from the guardians of the children it tested the medicine on. The drugs company counters that it got verbal consent from the parents of the affected children. Across northern Nigeria, the widely reported deaths of the children created enduring distrust of Western pharmaceutical companies. There is a widespread belief that there is a deliberate attempt to harm them. Consequently, many parents have refused to allow their children to be vaccinated for polio, setting back a 20-year program to eliminate the disease. Ismail Bello is a Nigerian Muslim concerned about the prevalence of polio in Nigeria's predominantly Muslim north.
This unfortunate incident sent wrong signals to the populace, and that affected the sources of the immunization program. It was not difficult for people to say, no, you need to be cautious in allowing your wards, your children, to be vaccinated, so to say. And that went around very quickly, and the entire community was mobilized against the polio issue.
The Nigerian government is claiming damages from Pfizer for the public health problem caused by this reluctance of the Muslim populace to take polio vaccines. The two cases against the American company are due to commence early next month. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
Free Speech Radio News is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. To find out how you can support FSRN's programming, just visit our website at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.
Good evening. You are listening to 90.7, the Mighty Boo, KBOO, your community radio station. This is Michael Anderson, and this is Hole in the Bucket, your show on housing and homelessness and poverty issues and issues related to them. And we have a very good show tonight. We have two subjects. The first is a group called Pangea, which is connecting people with opportunities for social change. And then we have a report from Clackamas County on their annual homeless count and what they found. But to start out tonight, we have in the studio with me Deb, Stephanie, and Elijah from Pangea. Good evening.
Hi.
How are y'all doing?
Good, thanks.
Good. Well, so the Pangea Project, what is the Pangea Project, and why should our listeners be interested?
Well, the Pangea Project is a nonprofit organization in Portland, and we exist to empower low-income youth to become globally aware local leaders. That's our goal.
It's a 10-month program that gets low-income teens involved in both local and international service learning projects.
You know, a lot of times when I hear terminology like low income, the implication is, how should I say, it's a class of people that is treated lower or is helpless, or we need to rally around. But what I'm hearing about this program, and as I researched it a little bit more, it sounds like you guys have a completely different mentality, and rather seeing as people in need, seeing as people as an asset.
Well, really the whole idea of the Pangea Project is that everybody can make a difference in the world and that everybody has value, everybody's intelligent, a lot of people. I mean, low-income teens care and just as much as anyone else about what's going on in the world. They're just as intelligent, bright, curious, motivated. Our program is really just about access, and we value the contributions of everybody, and we've really based the whole program around that idea. We call it change makers, and this idea that no matter what you come from, if you care and if you take action and you're passionate about something, then you really can do something about it. So
to give our listeners a better idea, I mean, you've already given a general description of what it is, but what would it look like for a program participant? I mean, what do you do with the Pangea Project?
Well, we work with different high schools around the community. So this year we're working with Portland Youth Builders, an alternative high school. And the students engage in a 10-month-long program that has 1 month of an international focus, but it's a much more comprehensive program than just this international trip. But that is one piece of it. And the students, each group studies a theme and a country. So this year's group is studying housing and homelessness in Ecuador, and they also study it in Portland. the first component, they learn all about the theme in our community here. They learn about why homelessness exists, what projects are going on to alleviate the issue, what the city's doing. They do service projects. So they really get immersed into that issue here in this community. And they start to meet and learn about what Deb was talking about, change makers. So local grassroots leaders who are making a difference. And the message that we give our students over and over is that you don't have to be rich or famous to make a difference. You just have to care. And you have to have the skills to be a leader. After this training component, the students go, this year they'll go to Ecuador and they'll study the theme on a global level. And they'll meet change makers and leaders internationally also working on the issue. And they live with host families and do service projects internationally. And then the follow-up component we call local leadership, and that takes place in the fall. And that's when the students come back as leaders and experts on this issue, and they come back to educate their own community about what they learned.
So then, Elijah, you're a participant in this year's program.
Yes.
And so this trip to Ecuador is over the summer. It's coming up.
26th of this month.
And have you ever been to Ecuador?
No,
before?
I haven't.
No, me neither. What are you thinking? Are you nervous? Are you feeling prepared?
Yeah, I'm really nervous. I think it'll be a real good learning experience for me and the other students also. And I'm just anxious to learn about their culture and how they live their life each day.
One of the things that I first got familiar with the Pangea Project was in the last Street Roots, there was poetry published mm-hmm. by members of the project, including, you had a piece
yes.
in there? And you have a piece to share with us this evening?
Yes, I do.
All right. Are you ready?
Yes.
All right. So here's Elijah with the poem, and I'll let you go from here.
This poem is about housing and homelessness. Eric pushed me to make this poem. It's called A Televised Revolution. When I hear that the revolution will not be televised, I think of a nation that fails to see true dignity and respect, which comes from the evil thoughts of the enemy indirect. I see many revolutions being formed, but voices not being heard because of anonymous organizations and fear of other people spreading the word. I see homeless people crying out because they have no food, medication, or shelter. It is though their voices are heavyweight but being treated as welter. I see people with nothing saying that there will come an end, and some newscasters spreading nonsense, just ignoring the trend. I see people dressed in rags, wishing that they could have cash, getting arrested because they're in a parking lot with a basket and bags. It sickens my brain to see the hurt that comes in the struggle, especially when suffering from sickness and within a day you feel double. But today's pain is tomorrow's game, and the systems will get put to shame, and they will finally look at life as a process and not a game. I can feel the difficulties surrounding the homeless life and strife. They are like increased famines with anger binding the sharp as a knife. But I believe that when a revolution is televised, the ending will come. When we all gather around as a nation and one. When we all gather around as a nation and one.
All right. That's a nice piece of work. Now, were you a poet before you got involved in
yes.
this project?
Yeah.
Wow, so you brought that skill to the table.
Yes.
Here. Now, did you ever think that you would be reading your poetry
no.
on the air?
Oh,
well, you definitely have a talent like it. So Elijah brings poetry to the table. I assume the different kids are all bringing different talents. This is not the first year of the project, right? So you've had kids go through before. Talk about some of the kids and what they brought to the table and what's going on with them.
Well, I think most of them bring just a lot of curiosity about what's going on. Last year's group, the transformation was beyond what we could have imagined. We pretty much bet our lives on the fact that the 10 months with us and going to Ecuador would really, you know, change their perception of things and their sense of, you know, their, just what they can do in their life. And now they're just on fire. I mean, to a point where actually we've realized we want to develop a graduate program because we really want to take what their energy and kind of bring it to the next level. So the students are, they've done all sorts of things. We have students who got full ride scholarships to college when they weren't even planning on going to college. We have students that got involved in Greenpeace and Amnesty International when they got back. They're funny, they're bright, they're cool, they're, you know, they're just, it's both groups. I mean, really, really great students. We're actually really lucky. And, you know, they've been through a lot of different stuff in their life. And it's amazing because I think that they have the sense that there's more. You know, there's a way that they can take what they've been through and turn it into something powerful. And so it's been really just a nice experience, more than nice. It's been a pretty incredible experience to watch that happen. And this is our second group of students this year. Yeah.
And how many students are in a group?
Every year we will have around 8 to 12. So we'll top it off probably at around 12. And this year we have 9 students traveling with us.
Wow. And now, Elijah, do you speak Spanish?
Yeah.
Me hablo un poquito, and that's how I always get nervous. Now, do you two speak Spanish?
Enough to get by. But we actually partner with, we have in-country coordinators in Ecuador that are working with us and will travel with us and translate. And we're teaching the students some basic Spanish. So when they get down there, they have some of those skills. But actually, one of the most interesting things last year was the students having the realization of how communication can occur beyond language, mm-hmm. and how powerful that can be. So living with host families for 2 weeks, we have students who really didn't speak any Spanish, and they came back with just these amazing stories of connecting with people and realizing that human beings can connect in so many ways. So it actually was an interesting part of the idea of solidarity and the idea of, you know, human connections for us.
So how did you connect with these folks in Ecuador? Is that partly how the project got started, or did the project start and then you found a good partner in the folks in Ecuador?
Well, the organization started 4 years ago, long before Ecuador was a thought for us. We, Stephanie and I, started the organization with a realization that we had the same dream. And after a lot of years of traveling and volunteering and cultural immersion, that we had both always wanted to share this experience with people who wouldn't have the opportunity otherwise. Ecuador came about 2 years into the program. We actually had planned on having our first program be in West Africa, in Mali, where Stephanie had lived for 2 years serving in the Peace Corps. Went all the way there to set the program up, realized it wasn't the best place for us to do our first program, and were contacted by someone down in Ecuador. Who heard about our program, which was exciting at the mm-hmm, time because mm-hmm. we were so new. And that was kind of the beginning of this relationship down there. And then Stephanie and I went down 2 summers ago to set the program up and have spent a lot of time working with our friends down there to set things up.
So, Elijah, I know that you just have just completed this first part, the world-class part, but what do you think of the program so far? What surprised you about it? What's been cool about it?
Just all the opportunities they have. I had a chance to meet with a lady at OSU. She was a Nobel Peace Prize winner. Her name was Betty Williams. And I had lunch with her. So it's just like a lot of different opportunities that you have when you join this program. And I'm very excited about that.
And boy, a Nobel Peace Prize, that's real cool. And what did she get the Nobel Peace Prize in?
They said that she had seen, was it 2 girls get killed, and she decided to, like, make a way, you know, for it to be known. And how many people did she get together?
35,000 people in 7 days she gathered together to protest.
Whoa.
Northern Ireland.
Yeah, a Northern
Wow.
peace activist.
Wow.
But Elijah got to spend a whole hour alone with her having lunch. Out of 350 students, she picked him out and they got to become friends. And now she's joined our advisory council. So that's been a really nice connection, thanks to Elijah.
That's a perfect example, right, of all the different ways that opportunities come when you mm-hmm. give people a chance to mm-hmm. to shine and get involved. And
what Elijah is referring to is Betty Williams' story, is that she was a mom and a housewife and just driving along the streets in Northern Ireland and saw with, you know, the IRA and the fighting, these 2 children die, and it just inspired her to do something about it. And so she's a perfect example of this idea of change makers. You know, she was a mom, a housewife, just doing her thing, living her life, until this thing happened to her that just altered the course of her future. So it's great that we have the opportunity to introduce our students to people like that so that they see, you know, she wasn't all that different from me. Something just changed.
So I'm sure that we have listeners out there tonight that are thinking, I'd like to get my kid in this program, or this sounds like a great program. I'd like to learn more. Talk a little bit about that. How do you find the kids that get involved in a program? And if someone wanted to get a child involved, how would they go about that?
Well, the way that we've decided to work is to work in partnership with schools. And last year we had three different partnering schools, Roosevelt, Franklin, and Portland Youth Builders that we worked with. We had students from all of those schools come together for the trainings and the international experience and the local leadership. This year we actually got a grant from the Portland Schools Foundation when they recognized the potential that our program has to close the achievement gap for low-income students and really saw what happened when we came back last year. And because of that grant and because of an idea to form a different model, we've decided to work with our whole group comes from one school. So this year all our students are students at Portland Youth Builders. Next year, we'll expand the program, and the idea is to grow the Pangea Project so that ultimately we have 10 different programs each summer working with 10 different schools, each with a different theme and a different country, with really a vision to have the students cross-educate each other so that they go to a country and learn about a theme. And anyways, the partnership, the model that we're working on now is to actually have all of our students or half of our students come from one school and half from another. So next year, we'll be partnering with Open Meadow Alternative High School and Roosevelt High School for one group, so half the students from each school. And then the other group will be from also, again, from Portland Youth Builders. And we'll continue to go back to Ecuador every summer, and then as we grow, we'll build in new countries. And so the solidarity and the relationship building happens not only in Portland with the organizations we work with here, but also in the country that we travel to, so that every year we go back and we start really forming some relationships there that can kind of allow us to have a bigger impact, but to also just the connection will be even deeper with the people there.
Yeah, that's one of the things that occurs to me is this exchange. I mean, it seems like the whole basic principle that you're working on is exchange and giving people the opportunity to exchange what they have. And when I was doing some of the reading, I mean, one of the things that Elijah and any of the program participants are going to be doing down in Ecuador is being involved in local activity there that's making a difference there locally. And yeah, it just seems like that's naturally going to build a strength of relationships.
Well, I think, you know, a key kind of a fundamental aspect of the Pangea Project is this idea of solidarity versus charity and an idea of empathy versus sympathy. It's really the idea is that, you know, if we can create connections that are genuine, that are not top down, that are really grassroots and that are based on finding commonalities of people working together, realizing that everybody has something to offer. We work with indigenous people, we work with farmers, with that as the basis, it really does become what you're talking about. It's not, I think that the idea is to make those connections steeped in.
I know where you're going, that it builds a more fundamental relationship, not just on a surface level, but on a deeper human connection, not just on in a, you know, fluffy emotional way, but in this real bond. You work together, you get to know people, you develop a camaraderie.
Yeah, we're not going to help people. We're going to connect and meet people and learn from them.
Yeah, it's more like, you know, I think about, you know, I guess we don't really have this much in this country anymore, but there used to be a time in smaller communities like if somebody's barn burnt down, then everybody come together and build the barn together. And it's like, well, you helping this sorry person who had their barn burnt down, or is everybody just stepping up and saying, all right, somebody, you know, took a hit, let's all, you know, make it better?
Yeah, there's actually in Ecuador this practice, and the word is minga in Spanish, and that's exactly what happens. It's this community get together around helping an individual. So if somebody needs a house, the whole community, the town, the village will come together and build this person their house along with them. And then their responsibility is to help the next person that needs assistance. And there's no money exchanging. It's just that community coming together. And it's pretty powerful to be a part of.
Well, amazingly enough, our time is moving on here. And it happens every single time. That's why I made sure we got the poem in up front so we could make sure we could all get that. But now, tell us about your website. How do people get in contact and find out more? We could have listeners out there who maybe want to make a contribution to help support your organization. How would they do that?
Well, a couple things that I wanted to say is that, like you mentioned, Street Roots had Elijah's poem in it, the June 1st issue. And every issue of Street Roots, Pangea students will be writing something. We had Elijah's poem with a piece of artwork. We have articles. But for the next 6 months or so, Pangea will be represented. So the listeners should definitely support Street Roots because they're a great paper, and also they can read more about Pangea that way.
Cool.
We also wanted to make sure everybody knows about our bike scavenger hunt, which is this Saturday, June 16th, and it's from 9 until about 2 o'clock. And the cool thing about it's a fundraiser for the Pangea Project, and it's a scavenger hunt all over the city of Portland on bicycle. And all of the clues are organizations working on housing and homelessness issues in Portland. So the idea is to not only raise money for Pangea, to get out in the sun and ride bikes around town, wear costumes, hopefully, but it's also to have people learn about the organizations that are working on solutions, the change makers, the people that we're educating our students about, and that they're working alongside during the Portland part of our program. So we'd love as many people as possible to come get on their bikes, learn about housing and homelessness, and help support the program. And they'll also meet the students along the way. They'll be located within the clues.
So where do you go? Where's the starting place?
The starting place is across the street from our office, which is 2736 MLK.
2736 MLK. Oh, we're Northeast. Right down the street from one another.
Yeah.
All
right. Wow. Great. Uh-huh.
Huh,
neighbors.
What do you know? Yeah, yeah. Right, I'm at 2627
cool.
Northeast MLK. How funny. What do you know?
Bridges Restaurant. We're next door, and it's actually the parking lot across the street from the old Billy Reed's is where you'll see balloons and you can get on our website to register. And our website is www.thepangeaproject.org, and it's P-A-N-G-A-E-A. And our phone number is 503-517-8999. We always can use more volunteers. We often have board openings on our board of directors, and of course, if anyone wants to give a donation, that's what we build the organization on. Yeah. So they're always appreciated.
Well, and it seems like it's an investment that goes a long way. So, well, this is wonderful work that you're doing. Elijah, great poetry there. Keep it up. Good luck in Ecuador. Great work, and good luck with the Pangea Project and the bike scavenger hunt and everything.
Thanks,
well,
Michael.
We're going to take a small musical break. We're going to go back to that Norah Jones we heard the beginning of, and then we'll be back here in about 3 minutes with Liz Bartel from Clackamas County.
Sunrise, sunrise, looks like morning in. But the clock's held 9:15 for hours. Sunrise, sunrise, couldn't tempt us if it tried, 'cause the afternoon's already come and gone. And I said, who? Sure, it's written all over my face. Surprise, surprise, never something I could hide. When I see we made it through another day, then I say, who? Thank you. grass covered down. It's the only way to bring me back. Ooh. 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 To you.
Welcome back. This is Michael Anderson in the Hole in the Bucket Show on your community radio station, 90.7 on your FM dial. It is around 6:28 in the evening. And thanks again to the Pangea Project for coming on the show. Now we are going to talk about the Clackamas County one-night homeless count, which happened back in January. But there was just a press conference on June 7th. On the show, we've done a lot of discussion. You know, particularly there was a lot of excitement generated when the city of Portland reported earlier this spring a dramatic 39% drop in homelessness from their 2005 to 2007 numbers. And yet, also, we know from around the region and around the state that the news hasn't been as good. Clackamas County, in their one-night 2005 count, counted roughly 2,500 people homeless in the county. In the January 2000 count, that number jumped by 1,000, slightly over 1,000. So it's a very dramatic rise. So I'm joined tonight by Liz Bartel, who works for Clackamas County and was involved in the homeless count. And good evening, Liz.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for coming after you had a dental appointment. Yeah,
sure.
Well, this won't be like pulling teeth. This will be a lot less painful. So, boy, that's a big spike out in Clackamas County. What to talk about the count? What did you see? What changed?
Well, I think that one of the things that changed is that I think that we did an even better job of doing the count this time. We recruited 130 volunteers who contributed about 1,000 hours of volunteer time. Our count coordinator, who worked with me on the count, was really well networked in Clackamas County. That was Lynn Deschler. She was able to coordinate the work very well. And I think that we simply penetrated the county better than we did in 2005. And the 2005 count was a good one, but I think we just built on that. We've always looked for opportunities to build on what we've done in the past. We actually have a manual that in which we record what we did and what the opportunities are for improvement. And so when we begin again, 2 years hence, we look at what we need to do differently and really focus on recruiting volunteers, recruiting bilingual volunteers, penetrating the rural areas of the county. All of those kinds of things really help.
So then is this spike in the numbers that we've seen, is that more related to the type of count you're doing, or do you think that there's been a rise or increase in homelessness?
Well, it's hard to say because we, of course, don't count everyone, and we know that we don't. I believe that probably there has been some increase in Clackamas County in homelessness, and I also think that a lot of the reason that we counted more people is that we simply did an even better job conducting the count this time.
Well, and I know that's something Washington County showed an increase of about 550 people. They had somewhere in the ballpark of 700-something 2 years ago, and now they're up to 1,200-something. Mm-hmm. And I think in talking to folks out there, they definitely feel that their count 2 years ago, there was a lot of good effort and volunteer energy put into it, but there was also a large understanding of, boy, we could be doing a much more exhaustive job. There's a lot of people that we're not connected with, avenues that might lead us to understand better where people are that we're not connected with. And so I think they attribute that spike as well. But it also – it just seems like 1,000 in Clackamas County, 500 in Washington County. Both of those numbers really jump out at me.
Mm-hmm. Well, housing, of course, is very, very expensive, and there are numbers of barriers to affordable housing that are problems for folks who have very little income. And it doesn't take a lot for a person to have to move from an apartment or from a place that they may be living with other folks, sharing a house, for example, a rental house, onto the street. You know, some people have very little margin of safety, and it costs a lot to live in a house.
Well, one of the things that we're always interested in talking about on the show is really digging beyond that general label, homelessness, and getting into who are these people who are experiencing life without a place to call home. So of these 3,000-odd people that you counted, what are some of the demographic trends that you discovered?
Mm-hmm. Of the households that we counted, now this is not people but households, 51% of the households were families with children. 42
Just families with children, that meaning children under 18?
Yes.
And related and
yes.
All those things. Okay,
yes.
Go ahead.
Or for whom they had responsibility
mm-hmm.
of some
okay.
kind. 42% of the households were adult-only households, and 7% of the households were unaccompanied youth.
So that's so over half were families, and then in terms of the total number of children, how many children were we looking at?
1,310 children were counted, actually, and that's 37% of the total. A shocking number of children were counted.
Right. You know, again, a lot of the times when we think about the stereotypes that people have around people who are homeless. Mm-hmm. Oh, this is personal choices, bad decisions. They can't clean up their act. Well, tell that to the 1,000 kids. I mean, what did they do?
Right. Those kids don't have a choice.
So but what's going on with their families? Are there families together? Are these working families?
Some of them are and some of them aren't. There are a huge variety of problems found among these families. I can tell you that on the survey, one of the surveys that we used, we asked some questions about what people need to get out of homelessness. Top things people say they need to get out of being homeless, money to pay rent. 52% of those interviewed said they needed money to pay rent. 40% said they needed money to pay a rent deposit. 38% said they needed food. 38% said they needed help getting a job. And 29% said they really needed medical care.
Medical care is definitely one of the common denominators that we see. We had a veterans group on 2 weeks ago uh-huh. that's located out in Bend. And as soon as we opened up the discussion, we're talking about health care for the next 15, 20 minutes.
Yeah, and that's interesting because they probably have health care through the VA system.
Well, there was some laughter about that. Yes, ostensibly, yes. But once you get disconnected and you're living outdoors or living outside of the system, uh-huh. those things break down very quickly, or mm-hmm. there's an 8-month wait list and no place to wait.
Right.
Or uh-huh. et cetera, et cetera. So what about veterans in Clackamas County? That was one of the focuses in the Bend count.
Mm-hmm. We added a question about or kind of modified the question that we asked last year or last time in 2005. 8% of those counted out in Clackamas County were veterans. And we suspect that there is an opportunity to capture a higher number, but we don't know exactly what it is that we're not doing. We just think that there are probably more veterans who are homeless than we're counting.
Let me push you on that because I'm interested in exploring it. And one of the things, just again, is background, because we've talked about homeless counts a lot on the show. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we talk about is sort of the inherent challenges of getting, you know, a count you can bank on or whatever, that by the very nature, people who are homeless for often very good reasons right. are wanting to avoid something like being counted.
That's right. They are. And I think that in the past, they were more willing to talk with us and they were in places that we would say were more traditional places in Clackamas County. They'd been there for a while, and we kind of knew where some of them were. But there have been there's been a lot of press about homelessness, and there have been more sweeps in general in the Tri-County area. And I think that people are moving from those more typical places back into places where they can't be found. And they're not telling us where they are either.
Well,
so that
yeah,
may be where
right.
some of the veterans are.
Right,
you
right.
know, you have a good point.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that was very interesting about this Ben group, which I won't continue to reference because you weren't here to be part of that conversation.
That's
but
fine.
One of the things that was fascinating about their work is in some ways because they were veterans themselves and had another avenue to connect mm-hmm. with fellow vets that gave them some access and some information to somewhere the real remote camps were. Mm-hmm. And they talked about, you know, that they were in places that were intentionally hard to find, places mm-hmm. where you wouldn't expect people.
Sure.
And Clackamas County has a vast amount of wilderness in
oh,
in
absolutely.
County.
Absolutely. I went with a volunteer up to the, beyond the Sandy area during the count just to see what we could see. We thought it might be more of a counting or a scouting expedition than a counting expedition. And it was, we found one camp that may have had 100 people in it. There were so many things that had been left there on the ground. I mean, you could just see that it was just a vast area that had been occupied probably into the fall. But then, of course, it gets cold up there in the winter, and there was some ice on the ground, and I don't know where those people went. I don't know if they went to warmer places or what, but it was definitely a wooded area, and by the end of January, they'd vacated.
Yeah. Which to me is it gets to another interesting area on this subject of the counts and what can we really glean from the counts and determine them. And I'm going to have several questions in a row related to that. But one is, so these annual shelter counts, which happen at this
yeah.
point.
Every 2 years,
mm-hmm. excuse me, biannual mm-hmm. counts that at this point, in a move that I think is very good, are happening increasingly around the state so we can begin to get a grasp on what are we really dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
But they happen in the dead of winter.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think the impact is of doing a homeless count in the dead of winter? I know it's an obvious question, but I'm interested in your opinion.
Yeah, well, I do think that we're not counting some folks and probably a significant number of people because we're doing it in the winter. Now, I know that ostensibly a lot of people would be found in shelters and transitional shelters, but we have so few of those that they're full, you know, we fill them up without even trying. And what that means is that there are a lot of other people left out on the streets. So I think that if we had the count in the middle of summer, we would probably count a lot more people, and that would include some farm workers and folks that are here for a reason in the summer.
Well, because I think one of the things that happens, I mean, we know that one of the challenges that people who are homeless face is often a deeper level of social disconnection where they literally don't have a lot of options of, mm-hmm. quote, places they can crash. That right. said, if you can find a place when it's really cold to get inside, whether it's with a buddy, whether it's in a dangerous situation, maybe it's with mm-hmm. someone you don't even know that well, mm-hmm. but they give you an opportunity, that's probably where people are going. And that's a much harder thing to catalog or track.
Right. It truly is. It's impossible, really, to count those people.
One of the other...
Except that we focused really heavily on the food pantries. And a lot of times people who don't have money for rent don't have money for food. And so we did do a lot of surveying at the food, all of the many of the food pantries in Clackamas County. And we ask a question on our survey as to whether people have filled out the survey before. And if they have, they're not counted. So that's one way that we try to get to that particular problem.
Now, one of the things that I noticed, and I'm going to go in a couple different directions here. One of the things that has been very interesting to me about the Clackamas count is that the main number that you publish and publicize is the actual number of people counted. But then there's also another number using some methodology where you extrapolate by the number of people you count that this is probably a closer number to what that actual representation is. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, for the listener, get ready for this. Sit down if you're not sitting down already. It gets a lot higher. And that as a matter of fact, by that extrapolation methodology, the number of people homeless in Clackamas County could be above 8,200 people.
That's right.
Talk about that methodology a little bit and tell me why Clackamas County chooses to break the numbers out in that way in terms of evaluating what your need is.
Mm-hmm. Well, we know that we're not counting everyone, and HUD recommends the count, recount, or capture, recapture methodology for estimating the total number of people in an area in a project like this. And so we've made the decision to go ahead and use that methodology to determine what might be the total number of homeless people in the county. And we have some wonderful partners, McDougall and Associates, Wally and Deborah McDougall, who are statisticians, and they help us with the planning of the surveying process and also do the counting and are responsible for the statistical work that's done on the count. So we think that we've been meticulous in calculating numbers and that we do want to know what the estimated total is.
But again, just to be clear, you're using approved methodology by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, who are the national folks that are, in a lot of ways are setting the tone for these counts.
That's right. In fact, one of the reasons we do them is to be sure that we're in compliance with HUD. We receive funding for the programs that we have for homeless people, for some of them, from HUD. And this is a requirement.
So one of the things that I think is interesting, and you know, I know most of our listeners out there are again, if they tune in regularly to Hole in the Bucket, this news may not be totally shocking. But one of the things, I'm trying to put on a hat of someone different. Call me Larson for a second. And I'm going to say like, yeah, but, you know, you're just inflating these numbers. I mean, you'll count anybody who comes. But then when I looked closer, there were about 600 people that you counted, but then disqualified because you thought it might hurt your overall, the veracity of your count.
That's right. We want to make sure that we're very conservative in our processes and in our numbers. And so that was a choice that was made by McDougall and Associates.
Wow. So ostensibly, you throw in that 600, and that would put your count at above 4,100 or so. And then, again, I don't know the methodology of extrapolation, but that number would have grown. So if the whole purpose was you guys were just trying to sound the alarm, the need alarm, you would have included those people. But in fact, because of striving to get as accurate as possible and really be able to have something that you could lean on, you did have that that check on your own data.
Oh, yes. We want to do a very good job at what we do, but we're not interested in finding more or saying that there are more homeless people than there are. Certainly, we're not interested in that.
Yeah. Well, another thing, and I this methodology and what's counted and what's not, I think is really important. I mean, it's sort of at the heart of this exercise, right, which is that we're trying to have the most accurate way to catalog and count a group of people that are very difficult to catalog and count. Mm-hmm. One of the other parts that I noticed about your survey that I want to ask about is that you broke down the numbers that you counted into HUD numbers and non-HUD numbers. And the HUD numbers were a little lower than the non-HUD numbers. Explain a little bit about that. Why have HUD numbers and non-HUD numbers?
Well, we're interested in the broader definition of homelessness that would include people who are doubled up together, but who can't necessarily afford a place of their own, who don't have the income to afford a rental situation on their own, for example.
Give me just an example of what that might look like.
Well, say that there's a young woman who lives in a studio apartment and she has a job and she's paying to rent that studio apartment and is able to get by on a modest income. But she has a friend who lost her job. And this friend just absolutely has no income and hasn't been able to get another job or hasn't looked for a job for whatever the reason. Is going to be doing that. But in the meantime, the friend who pays the rent lets the other person stay. And there are lots of situations like that out there. You know, some of those people wouldn't say that they're homeless necessarily. But the fact of the matter is, if it weren't for the beneficence of their friends, they would be. Well, and sometimes, you know, people aren't supposed to be having guests staying for longer than 2 weeks or what have you. So it compromises their own rental situation.
Well, it seems like it also fuel a constant movement of people. If you can't stay somewhere too long, that you need to find another friend to crash with, or maybe you get enough money for a motel for a week.
Right.
Or so that is particularly interesting to me because I think about families with children, and that seemed one of the areas where there was a difference between doing it using the strict federal HUD definition and then the broader definition that Clackamas County used. Because it seems to me if you have kids and you're homeless and it becomes aware to the public world that you're homeless, you're at risk of losing your kids. So doubling up or doing whatever it would take to hold the family together is going to be a strong driver for families with children.
Sure it is. It is. No doubt about it.
So regardless of if it's a more cohesive count or an increase in the number of people that are experiencing homelessness, your numbers have gone up. I'm interested in what level – have there been increased resources or funding for Clackamas County to deal with this challenge?
Well, we have been working on developing programs through our continuum of care and other – and we have been working on other affordable housing projects. And I'm not just talking about the county. I'm talking about private nonprofit entities and the county, and even faith-based programs in Clackamas County have been wonderfully helpful in setting up programs for people who are homeless.
So there's been a lot of local rallying to the challenge, but what about, has there been increased federal funds?
No. Well, actually, we changed the manner in which we're getting our funding from HUD. We've moved to an annual renewal process, which does help somewhat, but we haven't seen a huge increase in funding, no. And we certainly don't have resources that meet the need.
That's one of the things that I see as a great complication and challenge to the rise of people who are experiencing homelessness in non-urban environments is I think a lot of the federal resources really match well with the urban areas. And so then the urban areas, because it's a competitive environment to get this money, the urban areas are probably better suited to take in some of the type of money that's available. But we know around the state that a lot of the counties in Oregon have seen an increase this year. And I haven't heard of a lot of increases in the federal funding. Do you see I know I'm asking you to look into a crystal ball here. Do you see perhaps some change in rural or – I mean, I know Clackamas is an urban, suburban, and rural county. It's pretty unique in that manner. But do you see a change in the non-urban areas in maybe thinking about homelessness in a different way in terms of how to make the case that more funding is needed?
Well, I think that there is an increase in awareness of the problem, and that there are projects, small projects or groups thinking about these issues in the non-urban areas of Clackamas County. It is difficult to get around to, you know, all of those areas in terms mm-hmm. of siting a homeless shelter or creating an opportunity for ready-to-rent classes.
Mm-hmm.
But we do strive to serve the entire county, and folks in the rural jurisdictions are out there waving their hands saying, don't forget about us, because we have, you know, concerns here too.
Well, and I'm always reminded I've lived in cities all my life, but I'm always reminded when I talk to my rural colleagues and friends, they say, well, just to be clear, rural poverty is nothing new. Now, you knew that, right?
Yeah.
So, but I do see, I'm thinking back to the dynamic that you described of for in the general, be it because there's been more publicity around homelessness. In Portland, we know that housing prices have gone way up, certainly in a lot of the urban and suburban areas. In Clackamas County, that's very
true.
In Washington County. Mm-hmm. We also know that there's been an increase in sweeps, whereas, you know, it's 15, 18 years ago, you would have gone down to Old Town and it was literally anything goes, which was not a great environment, don't get mm-hmm. me wrong. Mm-hmm. But as at least people were in a place where you knew where they were and you could do a central service delivery plan, it seems like it's going to be a real big challenge if indeed homeless people are being pushed further away from more urban or suburban areas and more into remote areas to give people that safety line that mm-hmm. they need.
Well, I think, you know, just as we're all different, homeless people are all unique too. And there are some folks who really liked or prefer to be in isolated spots. But we've included some people who are homeless in the process of doing our counts. And we've, talked to a number of other folks who've been homeless or who are homeless now. And one of the things they tell us is that there are a whole lot of people who use the public transportation system to come into town and then who go actually to Portland
mm-hmm.
During the day to eat at Blanche House or Union Gospel or what have you, or, you know, to get other services. And so I think that there's just a lot of movement all over. But I agree that there certainly does need to be services in some of those more remote parts of the county.
Well, as is always the case with the show, whenever we have a good discussion, time just flows by like the Columbia River. So one of the things is I know that at this point, Clackamas County has officially released this information. Mm-hmm. For our listeners, if they wanted to get online and find out more, where would they go?
Well, they could contact me, Liz, LIZB at CO.CLACKAMAS.OR.US.
So LizB at ClackamasCounty.OR.US. So for our listeners out there, you know that's when you're connecting, sending an email to a city or a town, you know, you have that exchange in the back end. It's pretty standard. But LizB is the key one for this. And then is any of this stuff up on the web?
There is this short report that we have posted on the web.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And that would be,
we just changed our county web address.
Well, people can Google it. People can Google it. So Clackamas County,
it's just Clackamas County.
Clackamas County. Super. Yeah. Super. And what department would they go to?
It's the website for the entire county that it's going to be posted to. It's also posted to the community development website.
Community development website. Excellent.
Community development has been a great supporter of this process.
Well, I really appreciate the work that you're doing out in Clackamas County. I as an observer, have seen this count really grow and mature and the involvement of the whole community, and you've been a huge part in driving it. So the numbers are very dire, and it's not something that makes us happy at all, but I am very glad that you guys are being so rigorous about trying to get a real assessment. So thank you very much. Continue the good work. So we are about at the end of our show here. I do have a little bit of an announcement. If you have been moved by anything you've heard in this show, then it is time to take action. Right now, in the state legislature, there is a bill that would provide a tremendous, unprecedented, historic level of resources for affordable housing. It's called HB 3551. Write that down, HB 3551, and what you need to do is call your representative and your senator tomorrow. You can call them today and leave voicemail, but that'll be difficult. But tomorrow morning at 503-986-1000. That's the Salem Capitol. If we're going to change things, if we're going to speak up for these 3,500 people who we know are out there in Clackamas County, we know it's probably more, 8,000 people who may not have a phone that they can call tonight. It's our duty to follow through and speak up for them. So, all right, everybody, be well out there. Keep on rocking. And this has been Hole in the Bucket on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 FM. Good evening.
Sleeping in their shoes, but there's a warning sign on the road ahead. There's a lot of people saying we'd be better off dead. Don't feel like Satan, but I am to them, so I try to forget it any way I can. Keep on rocking in the free world. Keep on.